Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Here is the news of the world reported by our correspondents overseas and in our own national capital. We turn first to Russia for the report of Robert Magadov in Moscow. Go ahead, Moscow. Ladies and gentlemen, we regret that conditions beyond our control prevent our correspondent in Moscow from reporting at this time. Here are some late bulletins. From Moscow, the Red Army is advancing northwest of Stalingrad today after breaking German offensives both inside and outside the battered Volga River city. The Russians say the Nazis are losing 2,000 to 3,000 dead every day now in the long siege. And today, hard-striking Soviet units are smashing wedges into the German left flank. The enemy had laboriously fortified one hilltop there on the northwest front with 130 damaged tanks buried to form makeshift pillboxes. But the Russians stormed and seized the height. Squad by squad and house by house, the Stalingrad garrison itself is ousting enemy units from the shattered city. The government newspaper Izvestia tells of one column of Nazi tanks that stabbed into a workers' development at Stalingrad. It has been forced out under heavy fire from Red Army artillery batteries. In one street of the city, Russian snipers firing from the attic of a house forced two enemy companies to retreat with only a few survivors. Earlier, the retirement of a Red Army detachment south of the city was officially noted. But there's no word of new Russian withdrawals in that area. On all other fronts, Red Army lines are either holding firm or the defenders have gained. On the Bryansk front, southwest of Moscow, for example, 900 Nazis have been wiped out in a Russian scouting raid that penetrated advanced German lines. From New Delhi, India, American bombers and fighter planes have smashed again at Jap bases in northern Burma, neighboring Yunnan province of China. Air Force headquarters in India say that one medium bomber swooped down to a level of only 30 feet to demolish a building at an airfield in Yunnan province. The same ship attacked another Jap airport and bombed a concentration of tractors. Enemy barracks were the target of another bombing raid in Burma. In the same area, bombers and fighters also left three villages in flames. The assaults were carried out without the loss of any American planes. And now across the Atlantic again to the British capital. Go ahead, Alex Dreyer in London.
From London. The RAF followed up one of its most concentrated daylight sweeps of the war last night and pounded Germany's Pittsburgh, the Rhineland. The raid was the second in succession this week over German territory after a seven-day lull in the aerial offensive. Earlier in the evening, Britain's latest light bombers, the little-known twin-engine Mosquitoes, scored hits on an iron and steelwork from Liège. British reaction to the reported Nazi-directed arrest of the former French Premier Herriot, who has refused to join the jackals of Vichy, is viewed here as but another effort on the part of Laval to remain in the good graces of his Berlin boss. Laval has produced but 10% of the number of workers the Nazis have asked for their industrial machines, and the heat is apparently on. The British press this morning highlights the awards conferred upon the heroes of the Dieppe raid. One paper, the Daily Sketch, somewhat of an anti-American sheet before our entry into the war, editorializing that one cannot but wonder if uncontrollable zeal on the part of the Canadians might not have been responsible for a heavy part of the losses. Strongly hinting that military leadership was responsible for what it implies was a fiasco, the paper states that if success were not wholly achieved, the gallantry of the troops was certainly not to blame. The paper apparently fails to realize that in military field, success is not measured by the few number of troops lost, but rather if the objective of a raid has been scored. The Dieppe stab was purely a testing operation, and as such, it was completely successful. The first British correspondent to arrive in the Soviet capital after Hitler's invasion of Russia has written a book titled Russian Glory. It's the record of a journalist who had faith in the Reds, even when it appeared that Germany's panzer wizard Guderian was about to blast his way into the heart of the Soviet. In the middle of November 1941, war reporter Philip Jordan wrote, "If Hitler ever sits in the Kremlin as anything but a prisoner, I'll eat the fur hat I bought this morning." Jordan reveals that the greater part of the Battle of Moscow was fought with Russian material, and not, as is generally believed, with British equipment. Commenting on the work of Lord Beaverbrook in Moscow, Jordan flatly states, "It was Beaverbrook's biggest mistake to wave aside, during a conference with the Russian premier, the request that the British government should discuss with him the subject of post-war Europe." During a war, the problem of civilian food supply is never adequately solved, primarily because the demands of the armed forces are so heavy. As a consequence, this totalitarian war is producing some interesting developments in the way of food research. One of Britain's agricultural experts suggests that bypassing the cow as a provider of meat, far greater amounts of protein can be extracted from vegetable leaves. The leaves, says the expert, could be minced by machinery, the sap extracted, and prepared as food stuff. And now, this is Alex Dreyer in London, returning you to New York.
We take you next to the battlefront in the Southwest Pacific for the report of our correspondent in Australia.
This is George Thomas Foster speaking from somewhere in Australia. Australian ground forces are still advancing northward in New Guinea. They have now passed the native jungle village of Manari after our air force had strafed it for several days. General MacArthur's headquarters here announced that the advancing troops had been strongly supported by the Air Force, which has continued its bombing and strafing attacks on the enemy supply line. Although this village had been used by the Japs as a supply base, there are no reports of any equipment having been captured at this point. Manari is the third strategic village to fall to us, since our troops started their offensive only 7 days ago. Advancing from Manari like mountain goats, our forces had to scale a 3,500-foot-high ridge and then fly and drop down 1,000 feet into the village. They met little resistance. They advanced 4 miles beyond Nauru and expected the Jap main forces would attempt to stand, but it did not come off. So they moved warily along for another 4 miles through Manari. Latest reports indicate they are now higher up in the ranges, closer to the all-important dividing line, the gap in the Owen Stanley Range. In fact, they have only one more village to take before they reach the gap itself. Look for the name Taji in the news within the next day or two, for it is here that the Japs must make a stand if they are to contest us for the Gap territory. Now the Japs are obviously meeting with the same supply problems that hindered our troops before they withdrew from the northern side. That's the Jap side of the range. Possibly, the Japs are endeavoring to withdraw until we are again faced with the same problem. But in New Guinea, we have one paramount advantage: air superiority. Time and again, we knocked the enemy supply lines and bases. Almost every day, our bombers and fighters have damaged the vital Wairopi Bridge, thereby creating a killing bottleneck right at the Japs' most important forward base at Kokoda. If we can maintain this air superiority, we can certainly use it to hinder the Japs from messing up our supply line as they extend northward from Fort Moresby through the gap into the enemy's territory on the northern side of the Owen Stanley Range. This is George Thomas Foster speaking from Australia.
And now for the news on the home front, reported by Richard Harkness from the newsroom in Washington.
The president holds more authority this morning than any other president in American history. For late last night, by scrawling a bold Franklin D. Roosevelt on the new anti-inflation bill, Mr. Roosevelt took over unprecedented power to fix farm prices. and to control the wages and salaries of every person in the country. The president signed the historic measure at 10:15 o'clock in the presence of a group of government officials who crowded into his personal study on the second floor of the White House. And after the president signed the bill and blotted it, the group sat around and talked. Sitting there under Mr. Roosevelt's collection of fine old naval prints that hang on the wall, and while looking at political banners and other political souvenirs the president has saved all these years, this group made decisions which are bound to affect the everyday life of all of us. We'll know more about those decisions later in the day. For sometime today, the president expects to issue a general order and regulations putting the new law into immediate effect. Also, he's expected to name a new national economic czar who'll administer the law. The gossip this morning is that Governor Herbert Lehman of New York will probably get the post. The way Congress rushed the measure to Mr. Roosevelt for his signature last night, well, it's the broadest kind of a bill. Now, I don't want to get mixed up in all the wherefores and whereases of the new law, but here are its main details. Details I think we all forgot in watching that battle between the administration and the farm bloc over farm prices. First, the president is directed. Not authorized, mind you, he's directed to stabilize wages, salaries, and prices by November 1st. As far as possible, he must use September 15th levels as a standard. But he has the authority to depart from the September 15th yardstick to correct what the bill calls gross inequalities, or to aid in the prosecution of the war. The measure says the president may not. It absolutely forbids him to set farm price ceilings below 100% of parity. But the president may raise. In fact, he's directed to raise the ceiling to allow for increases in the cost of farm labor since January 1st of last year. And the bill also puts a floor under farm prices, a floor equal to 90% of parity. But on corn and wheat used for feeding livestock and poultry, the floor drops to 85% of parity. And if any utility or common carrier like a railroad wants to increase rates, well, it must give the president 30 days' notice. The Senate didn't complete action on the price control bill until around 8:30 o'clock last night, when Vice President Wallace signed it and sent the measure to the White House. But the Senate's work is just beginning, because the Senate Finance Committee has completed work on the new tax bill, and it now goes to the Senate floor for debate beginning next Tuesday. The measure will make American taxpayers dig down in their pockets to the tune of around $7 or $8 billion more a year. Before Mr. Roosevelt met with his domestic leaders on the price control bill, he conferred with the government's military leaders. Apparently, the president was catching up on war developments. War developments he missed during the 2 weeks he was making his defense tour from the Potomac to the Pacific. General Marshall called first at the White House. And he was followed by Admiral King, who's commander-in-chief of the United States fleet. Now, King must have left good news with the president. For later in the day, the Navy revealed that American submarines and big American Army bombers had been pounding away at the Japanese from the Aleutian Islands all the way to the enemy's home waters. Altogether, our submarines and planes sank 12 more Japanese ships. Agriculture Department experts are drafting a new bill today. A bill to start the movement of some 2 million families from unproductive farmland to large farms facing wartime labor shortages. The bill is intended to offset an impending acute wartime food shortage, which results from farms losing labor to the armed forces or to war industry. And finally, William M. Jeffers, the government's new rubber czar, is about ready to have compulsory inspections of all our automobile tires every 60 days. And that's all from Washington.
This has been the News of the World, reported by George Thomas Folster in Australia, Alex Dreyer in London, and Richard Harkness in Washington. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.